So good morning, everyone. It's wonderful to see you all. A privilege for me to be here with you. I have a very simple talk for you this morning, and it begins with wondering if there's anyone here who doesn't want to be happy. If you don't want to be happy, please raise your hand. So not really what you could call a large response, of course. Who isn't, however, unhappy from time to time? Yeah, much bigger response. So most of us are unhappy from time to time. So this business of happy and unhappy looms pretty large in our lives. And it involves a lot of making, checking, holding, and for sure wanting, desire. We all know this. It's different for each of us, isn't it? What most makes us happy. Some might want a great relationship. Others, children. Others, great adventures. Others want to know stuff. Others just want to gather up a lot of stuff, mostly green stuff, and on. Wonderful. Maybe you're one of the ones who needs to help others to be happy. Wonderful. Except that all of these roads to happiness have something in common. Oops. Suddenly I'm being asked into a breakout room. In all cases, we are looking for something to make us happy. They all require getting something or at least doing something. And therefore, for some of us, happiness is going to be in the end beyond our reach. Maybe it would behoove us to take a closer look at what it really means, but what really makes us happy, and from where in the end peace and fulfillment come. I take up this subject with great humility. I'm so aware of my excellent situation compared to most of the people on our planet. So many people out there are suffering right at this very moment, suffering deeply. Beirut, Belarus, the immigrants, the men, women, and children who are clawing their way right at this moment along the Darien Gap from Colombia into Panama. Parents in the United States trying to secure clean water for their children to drink. Portland. And in fact, I'm sure there are some of us in this very electronic room right now who are suffering right now. And of course, we also. So although I am also aware that at any time, an unkind word or a disdainful look can knock me back a bit, and that dukkha, dancing along in the shape of old age and death, will soon catch up with me, I am humble. Fortunately, I have the Buddha's teaching to guide me, and he gave us the answer to this question of happiness and unhappiness, 2.5 millennia ago. One of the first things he told us was that the origin of our suffering, our discontent, our unhappiness, if you will, is ignorance. Ignorance. That is, failing to recognize or being unaware that we are already Buddha, already awake. Failing to recognize or be aware that we are interconnected, all interconnected, not separate. Not permanent. Not changeless by any means. Whether we like it or not, we're going to experience one kind of pain or another, and we're going to die. Pain is going to be part of our experience. So we're all looking for comfort or happiness or fulfillment. But because of our ignorance, we are, to paraphrase Johnny Lee, looking for joy in all the wrong places. A Tibetan teacher, the third Jamgon Kongrul, once said that because of this, we do not experience our basic nature. And as a result, there's tremendous conflict in our lives. No matter how hard we try to work things out, there is always disorder and dissatisfaction because of this ignorance, always something missing. No matter how much we seem to have accomplished, there's always something more to achieve, more to get. Dissatisfaction continues, and its scale increases because what we are fundamentally and how we perceive what we are not the same. This constant striving that we seem to insist upon toward the next thing, the next moment, means we're constantly in a state of craving, of stretching out to reach something more, something better. And this, of course, creates a perpetual state of discontent and unease. This is always true, but right now, perhaps it's obviously more in our faces. For many of us, these are very difficult days. So what about happiness now? What does that word happiness mean? How do we see it? Where is it? Well, of course, it's here where it's always been, and we find it, see it, by recognizing, by living in this moment, by reveling in this moment. Even in these times of immediate difficulty, we can still soak life up and be grateful for it, amazed by it. When the dark days come, and they always do, what can we do? We can relax and rest in the recognition that this very moment truly is all there is. It's the only place where we can live, the only place where we can find the truth, whatever it is, find our true self. To deny this is to deny our own lives. This is an astonishing revelation when we really experience it, that time and life are one, inseparable. We've been told this ever since the days of Nagarjuna, and it's been retold by so many voices down through the centuries, from Galileo to Einstein and on. I'm talking about that moment when we experience only spacious awareness. Believe me, thinking is overrated. I do, as I'm sure many of you do, find thinking useful from time to time. For sure. It comes in handy when you don't want to be hit by a truck, or when you're trying to work out why we have to struggle with two pandemics, coronavirus and stupidity. But scientists tell us that only about 10% of our thinking really has value. The rest, if you think about it, tends to be repetition and chatter. And an awful lot of it is about the self, which hilariously is a non-existent mental formation. There is so much more to each of us than this pointless random thinking. I want to be clear that I'm not suggesting all thought is useless or unnecessary. Hardly. I'd like to think I put some thought into this talk. I'll let you be the judge of whether it was enough. But there is this realm of, it's also this realm of intuition, of creativity, and sudden realization. Thought brings these things to life, yes. Can make them tangible, yes. But when we believe that our thought is who we are, that our thoughts are who we are, then we create this separate self. Then we are no longer ourselves. Only a self we've made up. And once we've created that, we begin to create a whole world like that, and we're lost, wandering in a delusion of which we're just unaware. We're born. And then most parents notice that around 2 years old, Junior begins to work out that he or she is separate from the door he or she just bumped into. And from then on, there's no stopping us. We grab a nice, fat backpack, and we begin to stuff it with all the things we tell ourselves make up this self. I'm not good enough. I'm such a good speller. I need a really large TV to be happy. My car is the best. Other people think I'm smart. No one ever listens to anything I say, and on and on and on, until we get to the grand prize. I've got to reach enlightenment, and the sooner the better. And all the while, we're projecting one image of ourselves to the world, while there's another one inside our heads, right? All of it adding up to feelings of insufficiency and desire, wanting things to be different than they are. Most of us strap on this backpack early on and never take it off. But once we see this, we can free ourselves from it. Buddha said, I teach suffering and the end of suffering. He taught us to free ourselves. First, we see the chatter that's going continuously through our heads. Those beloved, even when we hate them, old stories that we've been telling ourselves for however long. Then we begin to ask ourselves, what is it that discovered this backpack full of burdens? What's seeing it? Maybe this happened suddenly. Maybe the discovery crept up on us. This growing awareness, not thinking, awareness, like Jeff Popsa was talking about. And we begin to observe what's going on in our heads and what emotions accompany those thoughts. Maybe when you're angry with someone else, you spot that what you're really doing is defending this ephemeral, unreal picture you've drawn of yourself for yourself. And that's a big step. At that point, we've seen that there's only seeing, no seer. No separate self. And at that moment, we're free and alive. And there's a new, deep sense of joy. And here's the thing. When that happens, not only have we saved ourselves, but we have saved all beings. We can look around right now and see this would be a wonderful thing. It's clear in this moment that if enough of us don't have this shift, in the way we see, this shift in our consciousness, soon we are going to destroy the planet, or at very least humanity. We have the capability to set ourselves free, to find this joyous happiness. It's our birthright. It's in every cell of our bodies. And it begins with our ability to watch the workings of our own mind. And you already know how that's done. Dark days are here. More will come. There's no search here for Pollyanna or Polyandra. There's a search for our ability to see life itself as it is, as the astonishing, perfectly complete, wondrous thing that it is. Then no longer will we take our sense of self from the contents of our individual backpacks. We'll be able to just take off those damn backpacks, rummage around inside of them, recognize the things that are inside for what they are. You can begin to toss them. In their place will be a much deeper sense of self, a spacious and peaceful awareness that gives us the courage to face whatever comes, to do what needs to be done, and to appreciate the doing. We call that functioning. We can spot our conditioned thoughts and emotions and recognize them as always changing, changing, changing. Then our ability to express compassion is freed from these entanglements, these ephemeral mental constructions, and we can just live. Like the palm tree, or for you Northwesterners, the fir tree in the garden. It's who we really are. I think perhaps all of us have experienced these moments of spacious alertness, times when there's no tension, only listening, only seeing, only awareness. Those moments can come when we're under great stress, our child is about to be hurt, and we have to get her now to prevent it. Where are you then, parent? You, the I, nowhere. Only just do it, right? Clarity, movement, only this. Then to artists, and musicians, and writers, and scientists, athletes, and more, all describe this state. You've probably heard about it or read about it, or for a fact have experienced it yourself. And the teachers tell us it's possible to live this way, so that our whole lives are expressions of that great immediacy, great creativity. And to make it so, as Jean-Luc Picard would say, all we need to do is to become present to this moment. Or as Jibong De Sunsining says again and again, all we need to do is rest in openness to the awareness of this present moment. Along the way, we come to the realization that happiness is just happiness. Unhappiness, just unhappiness, both ephemeral and changing, and therefore about the same value. We just see, we experience all of it, and we reach a place of great joy beyond happiness and unhappiness, beyond comfort or pain. And again, we all know how this is done. Meditation isn't about getting rid of our thoughts. It isn't about getting rid of our emotions. They're going to be there. It isn't about reaching some state of otherworldly bliss. We all know this. It's about relating to the great Zen circle as a whole, the absolute and the day-to-day, the relative, wisdom and befuddlement, without judgment. We just see and we let go. Because in the end, our thoughts are not creating the difficulty. Our longing and attachment and grasping, those are the problem. The Buddha taught a whole new attitude toward happiness, indeed, toward life. He explained that ordinary happiness never lasts because those things we talked about that created our momentary happiness, they don't last. Like day follows night, sad follows happy. And we poor fools keep looking for another fix. Real happiness is not dependent on an object. It's a state of being. It does not come and go. We still feel the transitory emotions, happy, sad. But we also recognize their impermanence and are not always grasping for things we want and pushing the things we find difficult away. Many, if not most of us, come to the Dharma looking for a way to put happiness behind, unhappiness behind us. We think we'll get happy all the time. But the Buddha said, if you want to wake up, you are going to have to locate happiness first. Remember, Zen Master Dogen said, to study the Buddha way is to study the self. To study the self is to forget the self. To forget the self is to be enlightened by the 10,000 things. Wonderful. The Buddha taught that the stress and disappointment of life, dukkha, come from craving and grasping. But at the root of craving and grasping is ignorance. And this ignorance is of the true nature of things, including ourselves. As we practice and grow in wisdom, we become less and less self-focused and more concerned about the well-being of others. There is no shortcut. We can't say suddenly, I'm not going to be selfish anymore. Rather, it grows out of practice day to day. But the wonderful result in being less self-centered is that our anxiety drops as craving for whatever we thought was the fix begins to drop. If you want to be happy, the Dalai Lama said, then practice compassion. But that word again was practice. Thank you so much for your very generous listening.